Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Amon Carter and Duncan Phillips develop the art collections that they would share with the public, and what can we learn by comparing some of the masterworks of the museums that bear their names? As my guest today will tell us, Carter in Fort Worth and Phillips in Washington, D.C. were accumulating works from many of America's most important artists during the same period, both with an eye towards sharing their treasures with the world. The resulting collections, both of which are still evolving today, are fascinating on their own, but even more remarkable when experienced together. The Amon Carter Museum of American Art is currently hosting a special exhibition of works from the Phillips Collection. You can see it through January 6th. Joining me now to discuss that show is Dorothy Kaczynski, director of the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C., and Andrew Walker is director of the Amon Carter Museum of American Art in Fort Worth. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
So the Phillips Collection has already been to museums in Spain and Japan and Italy. Can you talk about why the Amon Carter presents a uniquely interesting context in which to view these selected works?
Well, when the exhibit was presented in those other venues, I don't think that it has the same kind of appropriate contextual envelope as it does at the Amon Carter, where you have two visions about American art commingled. And I think that's a fascinating opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And for me, it was what's been striking. And even as we've had the opportunity in these past 2 weeks to really enjoy seeing these two collections in conversation, is also to be reminded that there was a kind of singular sense of purpose, that the works were not accumulated as collections like a civic museum might do, but that they were kind of built one picture at a time with the direction of whether it was a founder like Amon G. Carter and then his daughter Ruth Carter Stevenson and the curators and directors that helped her out, or Duncan Phillips and his crew sort of moving forward and thinking, this is very intentional, this is very purposeful. And so it tells a very specific story of America.
How did each of them look at American artists and their role in promoting American artists and sort of focusing attention on the importance of those people?
Well, the Phillips Collection is America's first museum of modern art, mm-hmm. opened to the public in 1921, and it continued to grow. It is not exclusively a museum of American art. It encompasses both European and American. And that was really a key idea for Phillips. When he had begun collecting before 1921, but he became more and more knowledgeable, increasingly focused. And he wanted to prove the importance of American modernism. He wanted to test his ideas by juxtaposing the great artists of the 19th and 20th century from Europe and from this country side by side to make a case, first of all, for the importance of a modern aesthetic that was still very unknown to the public, but to make a case for the importance of the production of art in this country. And I think from his point of view, to educate the public, but also to provide a forum for contemporary artists who really didn't have that possibility.
Yeah, I was interested to read that at the time that Phillips was building this collection, modern art was not something that was valued, particularly in Washington, D.C. He wasn't doing this, in other words, as a status symbol by any means.
No, I think he really embraced his project as risk-taking. And in fact, he described his museum in the 20s as an intimate museum combined with an experiment station. And we've embraced those words wholeheartedly. It's a gift to a museum director in the 21st century, you can imagine. He knew that he was showing unknown artists. He knew that these were not household words. He was not buying one of this, one of that, a sequence of trophies. He was really, he again used this word, encouragement. He was encouraging artists. He was very frequently subsidizing artists who we know very well now, but he was really giving them a forum, encouragement, and the means to pursue their vision.
He seems to have done a remarkably good job of knowing exactly who was going to be very, very important in decades to come.
Oh, I think so, absolutely. And what's been interesting, because the Amon Carter is slightly different, which mm-hmm. is it has a more purposeful historic feel to it in the approach to American art. And certainly Amon G. Carter very much so was drawn to the American West, in particular the art of Frederick Remington and Charlie Russell. And that had to do with his association with this notion of I don't want to say the pioneer spirit, but the sense of exploration and expansion that Texas, as a Texan, sort of he stood for, as he really was one of the engines behind the development of the Metroplex area. And so these artists kind of represented that spirit of enterprise that he saw so important to American character in a way. And he wanted to share, as he drew these artists into his own holdings and collected them with great vigor and great depth, he recognized that not everybody had this opportunity to experience them. And like Duncan Phillips, I think, wanted to make these available for the public. And so that was part of really the establishment of the Amon G. Carter or the Amon Carter Museum of American Art. But what's interesting over time is that in many respects, the work that Duncan Phillips did to kind of chart this sense of excellence over the course of those 5 decades that he collected became a kind of model for building a collection here in Fort Worth that began having a depth in the years after Duncan Phillips' death. So it was like, here's a roadmap. And I'm not saying that we followed it necessarily specifically, but it's been fascinating to see how those artists that rose to a certain sense of importance in the story of American modernism have become now part of the Amon Carter's collection.
So there's a quote from C.R. Smith saying that he doesn't think that Amon Carter was ever interested in art per se, but except as a tool for telling stories of history. Do you think that's too reductive?
You know, that's a great question. I think it is, in a sense. I think, and I'll put it this way: I think he didn't have the breadth of embrace of what was happening in America, certainly that Duncan Phillips did. And that he recognized that part of the art that he was so drawn to was about storytelling. But he had an incredible eye. If you look at the aesthetics of and the quality of the works of art that came into the Amon Carter from his collection of Remington and Russell, arguably, you know, reductive in that way. But the quality of those works of art is consistently high, and that he really had this sense of aesthetics, which, of course, then his daughter, Ruth Carter Stevenson, and it's often been one of her strongest characters in relationship to the growth of the collection, is that there's this sense of excellence, of quality, and that's been pursued with a kind of precision. And so one would like to believe that that was passed in some ways from Amon Carter to his daughter, Ruth.
Give me a sense of the kind of art history education each man had, whether that was informal schooling or was sort of later an autodidactic process.
Well, Duncan Phillips did his undergraduate education at Yale, and he actually complained bitterly that there was not sufficient attention to the visual arts. He wrote letters about it, how important that was and or could have been. His brother also was at Yale, and the two of them petitioned their parents for a small stipend to start their collecting activity together. And he was a voracious reader. He traveled extensively, but as his project became more and more urgent and expansive, he was constantly out there on the road, talking to artists, going to galleries, visiting studios. So, but he, you know, he was a very sophisticated thinker. I think quite educated in art and art history. Took that very seriously. Wrote extensively about the artists that he collected, and also about his sort of the intellectual aspect of his project. And of course, his wife, Marjorie Phillips, they were partners in crime. They married, I believe, in 1921, the year that he opened his boyhood home to the public, establishing the Phillips Memorial Gallery. But she was a painter, had a school. So he was also, I think, keenly aware of the needs and the processes of making art.
You know, for Amon G. Carter, I would say it was an intuitive sense in a way that it didn't really come from a studied background, but it came more out of the experience as a businessman and actually as somebody who was forging opportunity and really building Fort Worth into, you know, the beginnings of the city it has now become through his efforts with the Star Telegram, through the oil, and then ultimately through his interest in aviation. But really where he got interested in Remington and Russell as artists, able to tell this story in a of enterprise and of art, was through Will Rogers. Mm-hmm. And it sort of connected to this, you know, very much, I think, a part of his experience about his lived sense of the West and the characters and the people that made it up. I would say with his daughter, there's a kind of generational shift. And she certainly did her – Ruth Carter Stevenson did her studies at – her undergraduate studies at Sarah Lawrence, and art history was a part of the work that she did. And as she was then given, after her father's death, the responsibility to build this museum that he stipulated in his will between 1955 and 1961, when the museum opened, she really began a process of education, sort of saying, I don't know how to do this. I'm going to gather the great people around the country who have done it before and show me the way. And that really began with Philip Johnson, the architect that she selected, kind of remarkably, to bring an internationally renowned architect to Fort Worth in 1955 mm-hmm. to really begin this building of a cultural infrastructure for the city. And she brought people along with her. She had a good eye. She had an intuitively good eye, but she had great directors. She had the help of Philip Johnson. She had the help of the director of the Museum of Modern Art, of the Cleveland Museum of Art. She gathered these knowledgeable people to help guide her into an understanding of what was quality in American art. And in the 1950s and early 1960s, that was still kind of new territory. American art was emerging as something significant.
And we'll talk about that a little bit more, Andrew, because today Fort Worth has this international reputation as a city that really values fine art. Mm-hmm. In the mid-50s, were people saying, well, this is great, but what, are you crazy? I mean, was it considered really an odd thing to do to put this collection in the city, or were people ready for it and sort of clamoring for it even before it was complete?
I think there was, you know, immediately a sense of pride mm-hmm. and a sense that, you know, if I can say that the influence of Amon Carter as giving good sound direction for the city within the community that was really leading at that time, there was a sense of confidence. I think that there was probably a let's wait and see as Ruth kind of took charge. But she made a strong statement immediately with bringing Philip Johnson to build this museum that opened in 1961. And, you know, we're working – this is a slight aside, if I can, for
sure.
a second. But we're working on a project with the Dallas Museum of Art right now, looking at this effort that happened in 1963 to put together a small installation of works of art in President Kennedy and the First Lady's hotel suite when they were stopping in Fort Worth the night before he was assassinated. And it was led by Ruth and by Mitch Wilder and Sam Canty and other leaders at the time. But you would be surprised, perhaps, from the perspective today to see the depth of cultural sophistication that existed in Fort Worth as far as a broad view of American art, but also modern art.
Let me jump in here because we got to take a break. My guests are Andrew Walker and Dorothy Kaczynski. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Dorothy Kaczynski, who is director of the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C., and Andrew Walker, director of the Amon Carter Museum of American Art in Fort Worth. The Amon Carter is hosting the exhibition To See as Artists See, American Art from the Phillips Collection, through January 6th. Dorothy, Andrew, and I will all be on stage tonight at the Amon Carter discussing A Tale of Two Museums. So you can find information about that online. If you'd like to join the conversation now, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Andrew, you were talking about this story about art being chosen to put in the hotel room that the Kennedys stayed in their what turned out to be their last night in North Texas. What pieces went into that selection?
Well, on the American front, there was one work that referenced the historic collection, the Western collection. So there was a Charlie Russell painting. Our great Thomas Aiken's Swimming was the really, I think, one of the centerpieces of that installation as well. But there was also Lionel Feiniger. There was Franz Klein. There was Pablo Picasso's sculpture. There was Henry Moore's sculpture. There was this broad range of a kind of sense of a international modernism that was being presented to the president and the first lady, not the American West, mm-hmm. as the story. So I think in a way, Fort Worth and the certainly as a cultural – as a city with cultural ambition in the late 1950s and early 1960s was very, very ready for what the museum was going to represent and become.
I want to talk a little bit more specifically about some of the works that people can see that are in the Amon Carter's permanent collection and then the ones that are visiting from the Phillips collection. One great example are these two different Georgia O'Keeffe paintings of the same subject. Talk about those and how they differ and what we might look for if we go and see them both on the same day.
That's precisely what I mean by the special quality of these two collections coming together to have such close sister images within reach of each other. It's just fantastic. Our painting, the Rancho's Church, was executed in 1929, and the Amon Carter version a year or so later, mm-hmm. 1930 to 31, almost precisely the same subject, and yet really O'Keeffe's ability to imbue these simple geometric forms of the adobe building with great sense of different mood, a different sky, a different sort of moment in nature. I think that's a very precious possibility to have those two pictures in the same museum. What is interesting is the date when our picture was acquired, 1930. And that's, it's a professional deformation. I'm always reading the labels because I'm fascinated. Where did this picture come from and when? Mm-hmm. But that's really the great evidence of Duncan Phillips embracing the new. Many times he's buying the painting the same year it was executed. And the Phillips collection is a museum of firsts, the first mm-hmm. time to present an artist, the first time to purchase an O'Keeffe, the first museum to purchase an O'Keeffe. So, it's just a wonderful opportunity to have these two fine collections come together and to tease out the all sorts of levels of meaning.
And I think it's fascinating, this comparison, especially because when I saw it for the first time, to get side by side, or not side by side, but within proximity, mm-hmm. that you kind of had this expectation that they'd be very similar. But they are very different yeah. in their details and their nuances. It's almost as though it's Monet and his series of haystacks at different times of day. And here you can get that sense of O'Keeffe doing the same kind of a thing, although within a different aesthetic. But you know, the other thing that's fascinating, and it goes to Dorothy's observation about the dates, is that for the museum, it was a fairly early acquisition. It was 1971. So we were 10 years in, but we were really beginning to broaden that idea of what the museum represented as a collection. And Ruth and Mitch Wilder, who were really directing acquisitions at this time, were drawn to the Stieglitz Group And part of that was because of the example stated explicitly in later interviews from Ruth, because of the example of Duncan Phillips. And so there's this kind of wonderful moment of again, emulation of somebody that's really set a very high standard for this country.
I think that Duncan Phillips had a very profound impact on many different collectors and on artists. I mean, there's so many stories that the artists who came and visited, who felt that it was really a haven, a home, and apparently even in the 1950s, you could come in on the weekend with your cigarettes and coffee and kind of plunk down in a big old armchair and just spend that time soaking in the lessons offered by this really fabulous collection. So I think it's just poetic that we had this opportunity to have the collection here in Fort Worth.
I should hasten to point out, I don't think cigarettes and coffee are welcome today.
No. Though, you know, no, absolutely not. And whenever I hear those stories, I'm thinking, oh, dear. No, it was never a house museum. That was never the intent. It was his home, but he spoke of himself as a museum director. So it was really a collector. He was driven, passionate about collecting, about art, about artists. But it was a very public mission that he embraced from the outset, once he decided to make that move. And, so that was really the background. And, you know, he died in 1966. And it's only very slowly that the focus on being true to a public mission, all of the expected amenities from an auditorium and a shop, you know, all of that is relatively new. So that's special context to keep in mind about visiting the Phillips.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Jay on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jay.
How you doing? Thank you.
Sure.
It's been 30 years since I went to the Phillips collection when I was in college, and you know, I was always kind of just fascinated by how an individual would collect all this type of art and then display it in their home, you know, and there's a good, you know, there are a lot of the American art like Rothko's and the Hoppers and a lot. You're always fascinated by the boating party, which is just, when you see it in a book, you never realize how big it is in real life. But I'm glad you brought it out here to Dallas. I mean, it's nice that people who haven't traveled to D.C. or don't even spend time away from maybe the mall and the museums that are around there have ever really seen the Phillips collection. So I'm interested, how many pieces have you brought and which artists are here?
Thanks for your call, Jay. And before we get an answer for you, just small correction. It's actually in Fort Worth. It's at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art in Fort Worth.
Well, we have, around 100 objects?
Yes, 100, around 100 objects.
And representing over 70 artists.
Mm-hmm.
So our intention was to give a true reflection of Phillips's taste, but also to craft the story of his collecting, but also a narrative of American art history. So we really cover 1850 to about 1960. Mm-hmm. So you have the possibility of experiencing the uniqueness of his vision, which artists he prized. Some of them will surprise, I'm sure, because many of them are still not household names. He was really true to, you know, what he valued. And many of those artists are not part of the standard art historical canon. So you're getting an overview of art history crafted, I think, very beautifully by our curator, Sue Frank, into 10 different kind of thematic chapters. And yet it really does reflect the uniqueness of an individual's eye.
Both Amon Carter and Duncan Phillips were adamant that the museum collections should continue to evolve after their deaths. I wonder, on the one hand, that has to be really liberating as a museum director, as you're thinking about pieces to acquire and ways to change things. On the other hand, how do you sort of walk the line between honoring the aesthetic that they brought to their collecting and continuing to move forward and gain a greater understanding of the history of art in the present day?
That's a great question. I think it, and it's one that is, you know, is always evolving because the terms of, let's say, the terms of the pantheon, perhaps, of American art is changing generationally. And the one piece, at least from my perspective, that the Amon Carter has maintained as it's grown is the issue of quality, especially in their paintings and their sculpture collection. But we also have the breadth that we have works on paper, drawings, watercolors and prints, and one of the nation's great photography collections. And so that is, in a way, across media, is a sense that is one important way that the collection has evolved since Amon G. Carter sort of established the museum with Remington and Russell. I mean, there's a lot of growth that you could do from Remington and Russell. And I think what happened really over the course of time was a realization that the Western story was important, but that you could actually tell the story of American art and creativity as a series of frontiers. And so it gives you this great opportunity to actually take it as far east as you possibly can and then think about the growth of the nation as kind of moving progressively westward. So our collection has become fairly comprehensive now of telling that American story, even into the contemporary, if you consider our photography collection, which does collect into the contemporary. So we have this great kind of elasticity to be able to continually engage the American story of creativity and of expression. What I find fascinating about having the Phillips collection here is that there are areas that Phillips championed that we've never touched.
Such as
the Ashcan group. I mean, there are obvious ones like that group of innovative artists in the early 20th century who really began to take American Impressionism and move it towards what would become an American modernism. We haven't explored that at all. So there's an opportunity. And I'm actually learning, looking at Walt Kuhn, for example, mm-hmm. going, this is an artist that should be in our collection. To see the John Sloan, which is one of the great, great works in the Phillips collection, to say this, if we could find a John Sloan, we should have one.
Well, the good news about Duncan Phillips is that he was you know, I've used the word experiment and risk and encourage. He was a very liberal thinker. And your caller is absolutely right. We have great European holdings, including the Renoir Luncheon of the Boating Party, which is probably one of the icons of the collection. So we have the freedom to grow the collection, move it, lend it. Some of our sister institutions of the same vintage are much more constricted by severe rules about what may happen or not, and growth was prohibited. We were only hampered by the fact that there was not a great fortune in the family, so we don't have the funds at this point to have a really robust acquisition program. However, we are the glad recipients of extraordinarily thoughtful gifts of works of art because people who come to the Phillips very frequently develop a strong emotional attachment to the collection and think of us or the collection in terms of a work of art. But we are slowly, and I think this is exceedingly important to remain true to the idea that we are an experiment station and that we should be vital and in conversation with the contemporary artists of our time. We are in bits and pieces moving forward in augmenting our contemporary art holdings. Because, you know, on the one hand, he was buying Renoir or Walt Kuhn or Hopper or O'Keeffe in the 20s, but he was also, we are the first museum to have an ensemble of Mark Rothko. So he was daring and really out there to the, you know, last years of his life. And so I really feel it's our responsibility to find the means to perpetuate the vitality and the excitement that was at the heart of what Duncan Phillips was trying to do.
Did Phillips connect completely with Cubism?
No, no. That's one of the, maybe curatorially, I think, oh, cringe, what a sad thing. But he was offered, as were many other museums, gifts from Catherine Dreyer's Société Anonyme collection. And he cherry-picked and kept things that pleased him and he felt were harmonic with his aesthetic. And, you know, there were certain movements, Dada, Surrealism, indeed high cubism, that were just not of interest to him. She sighs, alas. but you know, we do have Picasso. We have Blue Period Picasso. We have later Picasso, Surrealist Picasso, and later. So he is not entirely neglected. But I think that that's the maybe the honesty of a museum that was guided by it was not collecting by consensus or committee nor by advisors, but was really – it really – perhaps that besides the intimate galleries, the sense of a domestic setting, which I think our visitors find so refreshing, I think they're also perhaps not even consciously intrigued by the uniqueness of an ensemble of works of art that – are brought together by one person's taste.
We are speaking this hour with Dorothy Kaczynski, who is director of the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C., and Andrew Walker, director of the Amon Carter Museum of American Art in Fort Worth. The Amon Carter is hosting the exhibition To See as Artists See, American Art from the Phillips Collection through January 6th. Dorothy and Andrew and I will all be speaking tonight at 6 at the Amon Carter about A Tale of Two Museums. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Andrew Walker, who is director of the Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth, and Dorothy Kaczynski, director of the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C. The Amon Carter is currently hosting the exhibition To See as Artists See, American Art from the Phillips Collection. You can take it in through January 6th. Tonight, Dorothy, Andrew, and I will be speaking more at the Amon Carter about A Tale of Two Museums. And, of course, the two museums are the Phillips Collection and the Amon Carter. If you'd like to be part of the conversation now, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. On the phone now, we have Carter calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Carter.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
Good. I'm so glad to hear that there have been so many pieces. I guess I heard 100 pieces of the Phillips Collection. You know, several years, I'm a very big baseball fan, and several years ago when I was at the Phillips, I noticed the a piece called Night Baseball. I think it was actually, the artist was Marjorie Phillips. Is that something that will travel here? Or even more importantly, was Marjorie really a prolific artist? Or she just dabbled kind of in it?
Thanks for your call.
You know, it's terrible to be caught off guard, but I believe, in fact, I'm just going to assume that the fact that I couldn't find Marjorie's Night Baseball the other day when I wanted to have it up on the walls because the Nationals were still in play, the curator said, it's not here, so it must be, at the Eamon Carter. Mm-hmm. But I did find an alternative baseball image because I was trying to, you know, rally the troops for the excitement. But indeed, Marjorie was a very prolific artist. She directed a school that was upstairs at the Phillips Collection. She painted a lot, and even Duncan Phillips put his hand to the brush occasionally, I think probably more out of amusement. But thank you for remembering that image. Everybody is excessively fond of it. I mean, it just sort of captures the excitement of a night baseball game.
Will you describe it for us? Is it just simply what's the perspective and what are you seeing in that painting?
Kind of looking down from the stands, or not stands, that's not baseball terminology.
I think it's the stands.
Bleachers?
Yeah, bleachers, something like that. Boy,
you've come to the wrong place.
Yeah, well, and sort of, you know, perspective on the green infield, mm-hmm. and you know, the other crowds beyond. It just has that sense of the vitality of a sports event, and many people ask for that. You know, when people are coming to the museum, it's Renoir's boating party, or maybe Jacob Lawrence's Migration series, mm-hmm. which is another key work, or people are coming as pilgrims to sit in meditative silence in the Rothko room, or it's Marjorie's Night Baseball.
That's great.
Both collections contain works by Arthur Dove, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was a particular favorite, my understanding is, of Duncan Phillips.
Oh, yes. Indeed. And it was, again, one of those first, I believe, the first museum to buy an Arthur Dove. And Duncan Phillips developed a long relationship, gave the artist a stipend every year, and had first right of refusal. So there's a huge number of Arthur Doves in the collection and a broad overview of his work. And some of them are just astonishing. There's a lot of diversity of medium and style and spirit in Arthur Dove's work.
Well, and I think that again is one of those great moments of intersection of affinity with Dove, but also with the Stieglitz group of artists, which seem to have been a great favorite of Duncan Phillips and had become a great favorite of our collecting initiatives through Ruth Carter Stevenson, through Mitch Wilder, through Rick Stewart, you know, other directors who really saw that moment is something that I don't want to say was quintessentially American, but it knitted together this influence of Europe, of America's specificity, and oftentimes Western subject matter. So for the Eamon Carter, it was this great kind of moment of intersection, and something that I think, and as Ruth Carter Stevenson, as I said earlier, has noted, that Duncan Phillips really helped to show the way.
Is there an ideal way that each of you would imagine people moving through the museum during this exhibition?
I certainly do. One of the great things that we really felt was an opportunity with the Phillips collection coming to Fort Worth was the scale of the show. I mean, it doubles the size of what we're showing. It's like we installed a museum inside the museum.
But you've kept the permanent collection up.
We did. Mm-hmm. And what our specific intention was, we took all of our rotating spaces, all of our temporary spaces, so the large special exhibition galleries, which are where you would typically come to see a special exhibition at the Eamon Carter, are filled with the Phillips collection. And it takes you right up until the period of the late 1930s, and you're kicked out into the permanent collection at that very same moment. Hmm. So you have this sense of almost continuity. You cross over and then into the latter part of the 40s and then the post-war era, which is kind of new for the Eamon Carter's fine art collection. And so for the first time, really, we're showing Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, the Richard Diebenkorn. I think we would like to keep it. Dorothy, is that possible? Because it really continues our story at this high level of quality and in a way that it feels so natural. And we've tried to use the space of all of our galleries to reinforce that.
No, I'm afraid I can't give up the Diebenkorn. It's too important to us. This is the Girl with the Plant.
Yes.
Which was painted in 1960. And then the Phillips Collection had a Diebenkorn exhibit the next year, and he acquired it out of that show. And that's just another example of that kind of cutting edge excitement, embracing the new, sort of fresh off the easel or right out of one of the exhibits. But I think interestingly enough, Diebenkorn is one of those artists most associated with the sort of Phillips mm-hmm. Taste or with the collection's history.
Museums sort of call and respond to one another in the same way that artists do? In other words, the way a collection is organized or the influence of one collection as compared with another?
I'm not sure if I entirely understand your question, but the Phillips Collection is unusual. I won't say odd, because the philosophy was that your visit is very experiential. It's your voyage of discovery. And so as opposed to almost every other museum I know, where you go from gallery A to B to C, and you're going from realism, or impressionism to realism, to surrealism, and it's all about the isms, Phillips very specifically said, I don't like that.
Mm-hmm. So it's mixed.
Mm-hmm. Very mixed. European and American paintings from the 19th century with something very recent. And we continue to do that. And I'm sure that for people who are more accustomed to this teleological progression and the comfort of those art historical boxes, they probably are thinking, what is wrong with these people? So I suspect we are not very much of a model for most museums. But again, it goes back to the fact that it was really Duncan Phillips's insistence that he wanted people to learn and to enjoy, but to experience. So it wasn't pedagogical in a kind of traditional sense.
And I think, but I would say that in American collections or American museums, or museums to American art, there is a kind of conversation. There's a watching that goes on because the story keeps changing. The way historians are framing it, our art historians are framing the significance of social history and its impact or issues about racial identity or whatever it might be, it continues to have an impact on the way that we retell the story of American art. And so that often has to, or at least should, have a corollary. When I was in graduate school, we called it curatorial responsibility, that somehow there needed to be a responsiveness institutionally to that evolving story and that changing story. Now, at the Amon Carter, I think there's been – and this is actually kind of different, but it's interesting from my perspective that again, because Ruth Carter Stevenson was one of – and this is something I learned as I was coming here, that she was one of the first – she was the first female trustee at the National Gallery of Art. And the National Gallery of Art, therefore she lived in Washington, D.C., and it had tremendous impact on her, not only as a model of institutional organization and of ambition, but also from a display point of view. And so when you walk through the Amon Carter's galleries, you can almost imagine yourself being in the National Gallery, not only with the sense of interpretation that's presented, but even the wall colors. And so there's this kind of emulation that can happen both on the way the galleries look and then on another way in the way that we're telling the story.
What is the relationship between your sense as museum directors that you are educating the public and that you are providing them an experience? And that's not to say that those two things are mutually exclusive, but I wonder if you have to decide sort of which takes prominence.
I think we believe that it's our responsibility to make the experience of enjoying the art at the Phillips implicitly rich, fulfilling, and educational. It's our responsibility to slow the visitors down enough so that they'll notice the kind of uncanny conversation across the room between an El Greco and the Oscar Kokoschka, with the sort of fiery white explosive brush strokes. We do, you know, we're not afraid. We do provide wall labels and some more explanatory information. You can use your cell phone and zap into our audio tour. We have lots of programming. We really have a very muscular public intellectual identity, because I think that's really what Phillips was fascinated in. So at any time you're coming to hear a contemporary artist about his or her work or guide you through the collection, we have a new series called Intersections. We're doing a lot more with contemporary art and programming exhibitions and at all possible with acquisitions. But the notion is that to continue that tradition of artists' response to the Phillips, and so they bring their work and they curate their own work in response to the permanent collection, which I think is also another way of adding to the context, the ramifications of the permanent collection.
And I think it's one of the great challenges, especially when the identity of an institution like the Phillips, like the Amon Carter, is very closely aligned with a permanent collection.
Right.
And there's a kind of sense of stability to that. So how do you make it relevant? How do you make it dynamic? A lot of times it is through programming. It is through very directive engagement with our visitors in a variety of different ways. And we take that quite seriously, certainly, because the notion of – it's not like build it and they will come. It's like finding pathways to ownership, whether you're a young person in the fourth grade or you're somebody with much more experience. How can you find your place and find that relevancy that resonates with you? And so it's a constant – that's part of our evolution. And I think the one thing that Dorothy's been saying that is very clear for us as well is that we're never going to grow like we did over the last 50 years as far as a collection. And so taking that resource and continuing to allow it to be responsive to what our visitors not necessarily want, but what is most meaningful to them is really one of the major responsibilities we have.
It's interesting to separate those two things, and it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm.
It's also, I mean, right now we have a temporary exhibit of Per Kirkeby. When I was here at the Dallas Museum of Art, my colleague Charlie Wiley presented a small exhibit of Kirkeby. He's an artist that is totally harmonic with the Phillips collection. It's all about painting. It's a borderline between abstraction and landscape. So that also helps people to think about the permanent collection through the lens of today.
Dorothy Kaczynski is director of the Phillips Collection. Andrew Walker is director of the Amon Carter Museum of American Art, which is hosting the exhibition To See as Artists See, American Art from the Phillips Collection, through January 6th. Dorothy, Andrew, and I will meet up again this evening at 6 at the Amon Carter to talk about the two collections. Thank you both so much for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions for the show, you can email those at any time to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.